The Guardian. Welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Jemima Kish. On this week's show, we have two unique insights into the enigmatic Apple Corporation by two former employees who've gone on to be big digital hitters.
We had explained to people why it was that Apple's perspective was better, right? This perspective of simplicity, the emphasis on design and all the things that Apple really did. Now these are taken for granted.
First up, technology editor Charles Arthur meets Peter Tamter, who joined Apple at a critical time in 1998 as it faced near annihilation. Peter talks about what he learned at Apple and why this stood him in good stead for his future career in game software and now the apps market.
That really the heart and the culture of an organization comes down to how does it make decisions and what does it reward.
And I meet the newly appointed chief executive of Good Technology Corporation and former Apple executive Christy Wyatt to discuss her experience working at Apple and the importance of mobility in tech.
So communications used to be about special purpose devices, and today it's about running on general purpose computers. That phone in your pocket is a computer. One app running on it happens to be called the phone.
Also, at the vaguely recent Web Summit in London, I chatted to Twilio chief executive Jeff Lawson about the growth of its cloud-based communication service APIs, and why the company is extending the Twilio funds to European startups. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Peter Tamter is a veteran of the tech and software industry in the US. He joined Apple in 1998 after being recruited by Steve Jobs himself and went on to work at the top end of the gaming software market with Bungie and with his own company, Destineer. Most recently, he pitched into the utility apps market with a rival to Evernote called Theory.io. When Charles met up with Peter, he first wanted to know about his move to Apple in 1998 and why this was such a crucial time for the company.
You know, at that time, you know, I think people might forget now, but in 97, Apple had just 3 months of cash left in the bank. Apple was 3 months away from not being able to pay its bills. And shortly after that, Steve came in and transformed Apple into not just a very profitable company, but a company that was once again changing the world. So to be able to see the very beginnings of that was the experience of a lifetime.
So in fact, you joined the same year as Tim Cook, who's now the chief executive himself.
Yeah, I think Tim probably started a few, Tim started a few months, I think, before I did, if I remember right, yeah.
So what's the view like from inside Apple when you're there? I mean, to a lot of people, Apple is a black box. It just sort of, you know, stuff comes out and there's not much visibility on what stuff even goes in. You know, they sort of know they have some suppliers, but no one quite knows what it means if one supplier says things are up, things are down. So what is the view like inside Apple of what the, you know, how the world is viewing you? It's like a one-way mirror, it feels like.
You know, I think there is certainly a mysteriousness to Apple. And one of the things that I think causes that is that Apple is so secret about its product development. And, you know, Apple figured out a long, long time ago that that one of the things that makes it successful in launching new products is to surprise people with those announcements. And so they go to extreme measures to make sure that people don't really know what it is that they're going to announce before they announce it. And I think that that creates a little bit of the mysteriousness, because within Apple itself, the what you find is a group of people who are extremely bright, extremely hardworking, and extremely nice, you know? And this is not necessarily, I think, what a lot of people outside of Apple see. They see the mysteriousness and the eliteness of the product experience itself. But these are people who care very deeply about the products that they're building and the experience that they're providing to the customers, because it's them, you know, they're creating these things for themselves. Right. And it just happens to be that the rest of the world likes these things as well.
The secretiveness even goes within Apple itself, doesn't it? I mean, I've heard stories about how the employees used to gather around when the Macworld things were happening. Steve Jobs was doing his speeches to see what are we going to announce today? Because they didn't know themselves.
Yeah, well, you know, the issue is, before Steve was on board, there was a joke inside Apple which said that a document that said Apple Confidential on it meant that you can only tell one other person. Okay, and today, of course, people understand the value of that confidentiality. And in fact, there were even stories of meetings that Steve had with engineers in the early days who were caught communicating secrets to people outside of the organization. And, you know, and Steve would ask them, why would you do this? And they said, well, we think that they had a right to know. And that was a very different perspective, I think, than the perspective of, we don't want to tell our competitors what we're doing years before we do it, and we also don't want to ruin the surprise when we actually announce these really exciting things.
So after a year or so, you actually left Apple. You were hired away by Bungie, who mm-hmm. were producing Halo. What was the view like then when you were on the outside of Apple looking in? How did it seem to you then? Because it was sort of, you know, from 1999 onwards, and certainly 2001 onwards with the iPod and then the iPhone, now the iPad, things have really, you know, taken off. And how does it look to you, you know, looking back, looking from the outside in?
You know, it's exciting, and also it's kind of in many ways it's hard to look at it from the outside after working inside of Apple and seeing the real transformation of the company and the impact that it's done. And it's kind of, you see, you know, at the time we were trying, in the early days we were really trying to get people to understand what the Apple culture was and what that meant and why that was good. And you know, at that time there was a real battle between Apple and Microsoft. You can remember that, of course, Microsoft made an investment in Apple, and that was the front page of newspapers and magazines around the world, that how could that Microsoft actually be supporting its nemesis. And now, and we had explained to people why it was that Apple's perspective was better, right? And this perspective of simplicity, the emphasis on design and all the things that Apple really did. Now these are taken for granted. And so it's in some ways it's just different looking at that today from the perspective of, well, everybody seems like they get it now. They get what Apple was, what Steve especially was trying to bring to Apple at that time. It's funny to see this organization that started with some very simple ideas, and how that has now broadly changed the way everybody, almost everybody in the world, at least in the developed world, interacts with not just their technology, but interacts with each other.
Okay. So you went to Bungie. They got sold to Microsoft. You went from Bungie onto Destineer, which was doing package software. And then 2 years ago, you started working on Theory.io. Just explain for us about that. Why did you make that move from the package software business to what you're doing now, which was entirely online software? And what are the sort of differences that you're seeing between those two worlds?
Yeah, the worlds are actually more different than I would have thought. I started Theory out of a frustration. So I've wanted for years to get rid of all the paper clutter in my life. And so I thought the iPad would do that for me. And it certainly did, in a lot of ways, get rid of a lot of my paper. But in one category, it didn't, and that was in note-taking. So, and this is the thing that I was most frustrated about, because I had stacks and stacks of yellow legal pads that get stuffed in my drawer and never seen again. And I'm wondering where, I knew I'd have a note about that, and I couldn't find it, right? So I tried a lot of note-taking apps at the time, and I found that they just replaced my paper clutter with digital clutter. And so we released a product called Project Book in August in the United States. And Project Book is a note-taking and to-do management app for the iPad that keeps you organized even when you run out of time to organize. We launched that. It became the number four best-selling paid iPad app in the U.S. and gave us the thousands of users, giving us ideas about the way that they would like us to shape the note-taking experience on their mobile devices. And now, of course, we're going to release Project Book for Mac very shortly, and also release a future iteration of Project Book for the iPad.
Doesn't the world have enough note-taking apps?
There are hundreds of them.
So doesn't that answer my question? I mean, why another? Why?
There you're going to see more and more of with what we're doing with Project Book in the very near future. I think we're going to answer that question much, much more clearly. But let me say in the meantime that there's two very big frustrations I have with note-taking apps right now. Okay. Number one is that the best note-taking apps right now store all my data in the cloud. Okay. And that's a problem for two or three reasons. Number one reason is because I don't have the cloud everywhere I go. Okay. I'm not connected to the internet in about a third of the places where I need my notes or my to-do lists. Okay. That's number one. Number two is, as we've seen, that cloud companies come and go. Mm-hmm. Okay. And now it's okay for certain of my data to get lost, but my notes contain some of the most valuable information and ideas that I have. I want to keep them forever. Okay, and nobody can guarantee me that what I store in a note-taking app today in the cloud is going to be available to me 5 years from now or 10 years from now. So we said, well, why can't we give people the same powerful capabilities that they get from the best note-taking apps that store their data in the cloud, but allow them to store that data on their devices where they control it, and then use non-proprietary systems to sync that data across to their other devices. So this is the foundation of what Project Book is available or about, and as we continue to do things with that, I think it'll be clear that not only can we give you the ability to keep control of this important information, but because we're not tied to proprietary systems, we can do things that the proprietary systems can't.
What are you thinking of there exactly? With the proprietary systems, what are the things you're thinking about? You know, what are you trying to avoid there exactly?
Well, I think anybody who looks at the history of technology is going to see that a core objective for a lot of technology systems is to grab control of your data, because once you're locked into their system, then they can charge you whatever they want. Okay,
but there's pretty much no such thing as a non-proprietary cloud. I mean, you know, it you can't find it.
So I can give you control of your data and let you choose which cloud system to use for syncing. So therefore, as long as that data is stored on your device, you have control over it, okay? But as soon as it's stored on the cloud and then synced back to your device, you've lost control of that. The most expensive product you buy is the one that's free.
So you're using the cloud not as the reference point. The cloud becomes the backup. The cloud becomes the not.
Exactly. The cloud is great. Yeah, I'm not a Luddite, right? Mm-hmm. I think the cloud is great. I depend on the cloud, right? The cloud is great for collaboration. It's great for syncing, and it's great for backup. And I don't have a problem with that. The cloud enables new behavior, right? Enables new things. But my problem is I want to control my data. I don't want to give my data up to somebody else who may or may not have the same long-term interest that I do with that data.
And what's your take on the whole app pricing question? You know, if it's not 99 cents or 99 pence, if it's above $5 or £5 or whatever, then people won't buy it. What's your take on that?
Well, that's it depends. Okay, the answer to that, quite frankly, is it depends. Okay, so there are certainly some examples of some more expensive apps that have been successful with a higher priced and very narrow vertical orientation in their product. The challenge that I see right now is that you have a combination, two bad things that are messing up the store. Number one is you've got VCs that are throwing billions of dollars into startups that have no chance. Okay, mm-hmm. They don't have a revenue model. They don't have much less a profitability model. Okay, and that messes things up for everybody else who does. Okay, because now I'm competing against somebody in an artificial market because they're being subsidized by VCs that mm-hmm. I don't think have thought all the way through, quite frankly, whether this company that I'm competing with is ever going to be able to become a profitable company. Okay, and then that's the first biggest challenge. The second biggest challenge is that there are no barriers to entry. An advantage of brick and mortar is that I really had to go through a lot of steps to get my product on the shelf. Okay, now you don't. Anybody can make their product available on these app stores, whether it's a good product or a bad product. So those barriers to entry are much slower. So therefore, there's a lot of competition, and a lot of that competition is funded with, quite frankly, investments that are never going to return.
It's quite ironic that the country which sort of promulgates the whole idea of, you know, the free market and market capitalism should be the one where you have this incredible distortion of the market.
It is a distortion right now. I mean, one has to look at technology over the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years and what has happened with the app stores in particular. And this isn't just Apple; this is on the Android side as well. And say that there are some unnatural forces at work in the economics. I don't know what some of the old school economists would say about that.
Peter Tamte, thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks for letting me be here.
Our thanks to Peter there. And to find out more about theory.io, you'll find links to this and everything in the show on our podcast blog, guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Twilio was founded in 2008 and is an adaptable cloud computing service which provides APIs for SMS and other communication services for businesses. It's also a company that has become a facilitator for smaller startups with its Twilio Fund, and this year the fund is focused on European tech startups. I met up with Twilio co-founder and chief executive Jeff Lawson and first asked him to sum up what Twilio offers.
Twilio is infrastructure that runs in the cloud that lets companies and their developers programmatically control the global telecom network. And what we're really doing is bringing communications into the realm of software people so that they can build the future of communications. And the reason why we're doing this is we see an enormous two trends, actually, that are occurring in the world of communications that make it so software people are building the future every day. The first trend is, you know, in enterprise communications, you see communications running from the closet to the cloud, transforming from putting boxes in a closet to running it all in a multi-tenant, scalable, reliable cloud environment. And this is the same trend we've seen in CRM and ERP and many other areas of enterprise software, and it's happening and will continue to happen in the world of communications. But the second trend is even more interesting. And that is the movement of communications from being about special purpose devices, right? 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, you wanted to make a telephone call, you picked up a telephone. And a telephone does one thing, it makes telephone calls, right? So communications used to be about special purpose devices, and today it's about running on general purpose computers. That phone in your pocket is a computer. One app running on it happens to be called the phone, right? Lets you make calls. But this is now the future, right, where a general-purpose computer is how you communicate. And so the people who are building that future are no longer the special-purpose hardware-type telecom people, but rather the people who program general-purpose computers are software people. And so that's why Twilio is letting software people be able to build the future of how humans interact every day with simple APIs that run in the cloud, give you scalable, reliable communications in the form of phone numbers, phone calls, and messaging that runs on those phone numbers worldwide.
Today you've announced Twilio Fund, which is an investment fund you've set up with Dave McClure. Tell us about that. How does that work?
Absolutely. We've got companies big and small building applications on Twilio. We've close to 200,000 developers and companies who are building on top of Twilio. And that's everything from your Fortune 100 companies building their next generation cloud-based call centers to startups. And so some of those startups are building fantastic applications that really do represent the future of human interaction. And so with Twilio Fund, and Dave McClure, 500 startups, the idea is to connect those entrepreneurs building on top of Twilio with one of Silicon Valley's most prolific and interesting seed investors. And our goal is to make those developers and those companies successful. And one of the ways in which we can do it, in addition to giving them the technology to be able to build their dreams, is also to connect them to some of the best investors in Silicon Valley.
It's quite unusual to find a startup. Obviously, you've been going for some time now, so you're quite established, but you're doing a lot to promote a lot of much smaller startups and app developers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a platform company, we are only as good as what people are building on top of us. And that's a fact of the matter. And so we do everything we can to empower the developers and the companies that are building on top of Twilio to be successful. In fact, it's one of our core values is empower others. And that's along those lines. We launched in the European market about 18 months ago. And we've been seeing amazing applications and amazing developers and companies using Twilio in the European market. And so when it came time to do our third version of Twilio Fund, we've been doing it for 2 years already, to do our third one, we said, hey, let's focus it exclusively on the European market. to help support the community there and help connect them with Silicon Valley, connect them with financing, and really help those guys get their applications off the ground, just like we've seen everywhere else in the world.
That's really great news for us. Mobile, obviously, is now the primary platform for the internet, and that's got to be good news for Twilio. So where do you go next?
Well, we've got applications that work globally as far as integrating with carriers around the world. We've got a Twilio client product that works in the browser with WebRTC, an exciting new technology built into Chrome and Firefox, as well as an SDK that works on iOS and Android. So basically anywhere developers are building an application, any platform, whether it's the web, whether it's mobile, they can be including Twilio in their applications with the whole goal of helping those applications communicate better. And that's the whole goal, because business, at the end of the day, business is about communications. It's a bunch of people coming together to communicate, whether you're talking to your customers in a sales context or a customer service context, whether you're talking to your vendors, whether it's your employees collaborating with each other. Communications drives business, and we believe that software people are inventing the future of those communications every day on all of those platforms and everywhere around the world. So our API should have global reach.
Jeff, that's fascinating. Good luck, and thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Huge thanks to Jeff Lawson. And if you have a tech business you want to get off the ground, it's well worth checking out the Twilio Fund at twiliofund.com. We return to another Apple employee now who went on to greater things. Christy Wyatt was recently appointed chief executive of the Good Technology Corporation, a company focused on mobility in big business. Christy was in the UK and came into Guardian Towers to discuss her present role and also the lessons she learnt about the tech business while at Apple.
Sure, I think Apple was a pretty large organization while I was there. I think that probably one of the least confused organizations, and by confused I mean very clear lines of reporting, very clear lines of responsibility, very clear decision-making framework. And I think that really the heart and the culture of an organization comes down to how does it make decisions and what does it reward. And so I think Apple was a great example for me as a manager in terms of clarity in both of those.
That's very interesting, because it's often the exception rather than the rule when it comes to their kind of business practice. A lot of the things they've been able to achieve, if another company set out to do them, you're not entirely convinced they'd be able to succeed. How is that sort of ingrained in the way the company operates?
I can think of a couple of the different organizations I've been with, and I think I can just maybe talk more broadly. The areas where I've seen companies execute successfully are where you have a clarity of vision about what success looks like. So it really has more to do with, did you define clearly in the beginning what it was you were setting out to accomplish? And then did you have a clear plan for getting there from here? And those sound like very simple things, but if you're talking about, projects that evolve over time or businesses that evolve over time, it's far easier to get distracted by the noise than you might think.
So the comparison with Motorola, mm-hmm. then, just describe what you worked on there, what you built, and I suppose how company culture there was different to Apple.
Motorola and Apple are very different organizations. I think Motorola was much larger when I moved from Apple to Motorola and had a much more diverse set of products, so they were doing a lot of various different things. I think that one of the key things that Motorola was very good at was technology and deep innovation. They're very, very rich technology base within that organization. I think one of the things we had to learn to get better at over time was really around that execution. We had a very strong leader that came in and talked about operational execution and really paying attention to the details. And again, it's a similar theme. Once you have a clear view of what success looks at the end and a clear plan to get there and you're paying attention to the progress along the way, it makes a world of difference.
I'm interested to know how these learnings relate to newspaper businesses, but perhaps we'll get to that at the end. So failures then, are there any common mistakes, apart from, I suppose, not setting out exactly what it is that you want to do and then doing it? What are the common failures that businesses make when they're organising themselves?
I think I've seen a couple. I think jumping from idea to action without sitting down and quantifying, again, what are you going to measure at the end of it? And so distractions are very, very easy. I can give an example of one phone that was kind of coming through the organization. And what the definition of that device was right in the beginning was very different than what people thought it was going to be good at the end. And as a result, you know, the technology that was kind of put into that product from between those two points was not exactly appropriate. So at the end, if you're touting this product is going to be the killer product for somebody who does this, and that wasn't clear when you, you know, put all of the bits together, then you're unlikely to kind of hit the target. And so now sometimes that happens because you didn't have the conversation. Sometimes that happens because you didn't think clearly and put the time in up front before you started doing the work to understand how it was going to come together. Or sometimes there were other shiny objects that came in along the way and you thought, ooh, I could also do this and we could also do that. And if we made it shiny here and rounded it out over there. And so it just sort of loses its purpose. And so distraction ends up having a big, big cost, I believe, on delivery.
Iteration isn't really something you can do with hardware in the same way that you can with a software product, obviously. And we've heard about, instead of ready, aim, fire, it's ready, fire, aim, aim, aim with agile development, which would seem to imply you would obviously work in a very different way. You wouldn't necessarily have as much of a plan because your plans will change.
This is actually a big point of debate. So among a lot of the organizations that I've been in, I actually don't believe that using Agile is in any way in conflict with actually good planning and having clarity of what the end goal is. So you can have a really clear idea of what it is you're trying to create and what's going to matter in the end, and still be able to iterate in the creation of doing that. The Agile process is really about, again, remaining focused, trying things, very quickly making decisions about what's working, are you getting the desired result? So it's it's an iterative process, but that doesn't mean that you're sort of excused from upfront declaring what the end purpose is. And so I think that actually ends up being a big point of confusion in a lot of organizations that try to head down that. And folks sort of go, awesome, now we don't have to actually plan anymore. We don't have to write things down anymore. And it's actually quite the opposite.
Well, the planning goes maybe 2 to 4 weeks ahead, but no more than that, possibly.
Sure, but I think that a helpful exercise I like to, or I've learned in the past, has been you kind of declare the headline up front. So if you said we're going to create the multimedia monster in a product, even though you're going through iterations and you're defining sort of what parts of that are taking what form and where the priorities are shaping, you still understand what the finish line looks like, as opposed to kind of thinking, well, it's going to be multimedia-ish and we'll see when we get there. It's very different.
When you say it like that, it does make sense. It's been an interesting point of discussion recently about remote working because of lovely Marissa at Yahoo. What's your take on this and whether it's more important that employees feel, you know, that they can work from anywhere and work flexibly and be sort of tied to the company in a different way, or whether they have to be in the office? There is a human benefit there, isn't there?
So I am a big believer that face-to-face plays an important role in collaboration, but clearly a big part of our business is focused on empowering people to collaborate when they're not face-to-face. So if a little bit about good, you know, we do software that allows us to take the office with us. So, and on whatever device happens to make sense, which could be the device you already own, it might not even be a work device. And so the whole premise of that is that you have a life that is quite rich and has a lot of different locations, has a lot of different computing screens already. Work is one of the things that you should do when you're sitting in front of there. And I think if you try to constrain that, users will find a way to get what they want done. They will find a way to get the data somewhere where they are going to be able to get the task finished that they've been trying to accomplish. And if you don't give them a path to get there, you might not like where they take it.
What's on your roadmap for the next 6 months then? What are you going to be working on?
We have a lot of things we're working on. I think that we're spending a lot of time focusing on the user experience of our product. I think one of the new things in IT is really this consumerization trend, and that's a really overused term, but really what it means to us is that consumers are influencing the decisions about where they're taking their data and doing their work. And so, as I said, they may forward corporate data to personal devices or to other devices to actually be able to work on it or work on it in a place where they are. So part of the challenge in solving that problem is addressing the CIO's need for security and control. And so we absolutely do that. And we have a long history of managing the security aspects. I think the other half of that is making sure that the user is choosing your experience to do that work and that they don't sort of reject it and then start that unhealthy trend. And so part of what you'll see us focus on is really more around the consumer experience as well as the security and a better collaboration between the two.
When are we allowed to switch off from work and work on our mobile phones? It's very hard to do when it's with us all the time.
But, you know, I'm not an incredibly interrupt-driven person. My mobile devices are with me and on all the time. But I think there's different kinds of digital channels that inspire different reactions. So I think you get to decide when you open those channels. The fact that your device is receiving communications all the time doesn't mean that you're allowing that device to push them at you all the time. You still fundamentally have the control over how overwhelmed you want to become with that.
So we need to develop the psychological skill, I suppose, to deal with this technology.
It's a psychological skill, but I also think it's a, you know, my family or my team, they know if they try to reach me with one digital channel, the time lag in response, it might be one thing. If they try something different, then it might be shorter. So, you know, if you want to send me a long email with lots of questions, you're probably going to get an answer measured in days. If you want to send me a quick question on a text message, I'll probably answer you in a couple of seconds. And so people are very savvy and you have the ability to kind of set the level of expectations by channel around you.
Christy, thank you very much. We've touched on a lot of things there, and that was really interesting insight into your experience. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Great meeting you.
To find links to Christy Wyatt's Good Technology Corporation, go to our podcast blog at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. That's it for this week. Many thanks to all our guests. Tech Weekly was produced by the excellent Jason Phipps. So from Jason, Charles and me, Jemima Kish, it's adios and catch you next Thursday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.